And now we're ready.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
We are now
Good
recording.
morning and welcome. Good morning and welcome to the March 16th, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for attending this morning. As our session starts at 10 a.m. this morning, will be a study session with a business session scheduled to start at around 1 o'clock this afternoon. We welcome public input at all of our meetings and remind those that might be attending, these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask if you are physically in the boardroom or if you're calling in, that you please state your name, your address, and for the record, and also limit your comments, please, to 3 minutes. Today, out of an abundance of caution and also supporting the CDC recommendations on social distancing, all five commissioners are attending this board meeting by phone. General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garpin, Clerk of the Board, will be in the boardroom. So at this time, if you'd please join us in the Pledge of Allegiance as well as the safety presentation.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America,
to the Republic, and to the Republic for which
one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So, commissioners, we're waiting for the safety minute. Is there someone there to give us a safety minute?
We actually have decided to cancel.
Sorry, we've decided to cancel the safety minute today.
Okay.
All the activity going on.
Okay. So, with that, we'll move on to approval of the agenda. Any item on the consent agenda shall be subject to transfer to a regular agenda by any member of the commission. Do I hear any such requests? Hearing none. She'll move on. Steve, would you like to take it from here?
I would. So we do have our monthly recognition of a cycle of personal ownership winner. We had two. Jennifer Dixon and Kathy Cowan were both nominated for their tremendous work, particularly because of the stuff they do at the end of the year, but I think it also applies throughout the course of the year. They do a lot of stuff throughout the course of the year. I'm always amazed at their ability to remember all of the unique things that go into payroll, because there's just a whole bunch of individual circumstances that get addressed. They seem to be able to organize that and keep it all in their heads and then deliver payroll. We get practically no complaints about payroll, which I think is unusual. And really wanted to call them out for the tremendous work that they've done. Jennifer is not with us today just because, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about some of the issues around coronavirus. Some of them have to do with pay. And so she's downstairs working away on that, displaying the usual dedication that she has around that. Kathy's going to represent the two of them. Jennifer came to our senior management team meeting last week, so Kathy's going to represent both of them this morning. So we're welcoming her and saying thanks for a tremendous job of stepping up and being accountable to make sure that we do a great job of making sure that our people always get compensated and paid for the work that they do. So, Kathy, welcome.
Thank you.
You have the opportunity to say something if you'd like to the board.
But Jennifer and I would like to say thank you for recognizing all of our hard work. We really appreciate people noticing. And just like today, we're working really hard on what needs to be taken care of for the employees of the district. And thank you very much.
Great. I'll turn this back to the board if there's anything they would like to say.
Commissioners, any comments?
This is Steve McKenna. So, Kathy, again, thank you. And from all accounts, from everything that I've read, it's well deserved, and appreciate that ongoing work. And I had a question for you. Is the current situation that we're in causing you any specific challenges or any new challenges?
Yes. There's all kinds of different codes that are being implemented, and there's all different kinds of situations for our people who are self-identifying as high risk. So with Jennifer reading all the updates with what the government has put out, we're just not really sure what to do, and we are doing our best to try to figure out what that is and making it work and getting through it.
Yeah, it's just changing every minute, I'm guessing. So anyway, I was just curious, and I appreciate the flexibility and ongoing hard work. That's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Kathy, this is Dennis, and I just wanted to say thanks. And just personally, in 14 years of being a commissioner, there's never been anything in terms of my paycheck that I would question. And I just wanted to say thank you for all the good work, you and Jennifer, and appreciate your dedication and the sincere effort that's made every month. And what you do is not unnoticed, but certainly appreciated.
Thank you for noticing. We have long days and we have long nights, and we're very proud that we can get it done.
Thank you.
Kathy, this is Commissioner Smith, and I just wanted to make a comment for those of us that have been commissioners for the long period of time. I, too, in my 14th year, did not recognize some of the challenges we as commissioners sometimes present to staff members, and appreciate the fact that there have been moments in time when we didn't follow process, and we're trying to do a much better job these days, not recognizing that we cause maybe some extra work for people, and we work hard. We will work harder. I will continue to not cause that issue ever again. So thank you for all you do.
Thank you. And you know, when you don't enter your time, we just move on to the next thing and come back when it's in there.
Kathy, this is Commissioner Arson. I just want to say thank you for the extraordinary efforts that you're putting forward now, you and your team. These are uncharted waters for, I think, all of us. I know it puts extra burden and demand on you and your staff. So as commissioners, we recognize that, and we really want to thank you sincerely from the bottom of our heart for all the hard work that you and your staff are putting in.
Thank you. We appreciate everyone noticing. It means a lot to us.
Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you. We will.
All right. So, Kathy, thank you so much from the team. Normally, we'd have the commissioners close this out, but we're kind of in this awkward situation today. So we just want to say thank you for your work. And we'll... if you could pass along to Jennifer, please, the comments from the commissioners, we'd really appreciate it.
I will do that. And I'm a person that likes quiet recognition. So coming up here and having to face everybody and make some comments, that was out of my comfort zone, but it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's I like to hear that people appreciate us. So thank you very much.
Great. You can go now. Yes. Commissioners, I'm going to move us on to the next agenda item. That would be the business intelligence and data analytics update. We have Curtis Cole, Peter Vanney, and Alex Smith. But first up, actually, Kelly Boyd would like to introduce this subject. It's moved over there.
It's right behind you.
We're not sure if it's actually working or not.
Good morning, everyone. This is Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, for the record. And it is actually my pleasure to get a chance to introduce this next presentation by giving a quick background on it. We established our business intelligence and data analytics program a few years ago by rededicating originally some internal resources to get the program started. And we had a real team approach where we did have a core group of people that started in a department, but there was a cross-functional team put together with key team members on it to really take a team approach to help with expanding capabilities throughout the organization. But when we think about business intelligence for finances, we've been doing that kind of analytics for a long time. And we've really been applying those techniques for more than 15 years here at the district. And I wanted to recognize Scott Taylor's contributions for that, because Scott was our original trailblazer. He really expanded our capabilities and tried to guide us. He had a real vision for the future. And so while we think about this as maybe a new program, it's really a continuation of what Scott blazed the trail for us on. So thank you to Scott for doing that. And then I think you'll see as you watch this presentation here how we've really expanded our thinking beyond financial intelligence, and we are now onto operational analytics. So I think you'll find it really exciting, and it's just a really fun thing for everyone to do to help us all be able to anticipate and expand on our decision making. So with that, I'll turn it over to the team to conduct their presentation.
Thank you very much, Kelly. For those on the phone, this is Curtis Cole. I'm the manager of BI and data analytics here at the district. And I brought with me today Alex Smith, our software and data engineering manager, and an analyst on my team, Peter Vanney. So we're all going to have some portion of this presentation. As far as our agenda, I'm going to jump to that one. I know if everyone has materials in front of them, it's slide number two. And talk through this. First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to come and address the board and to talk to the commissioners directly about what we're doing, the examples of what we have, and then how we think we're progressing in this function with the district. And I want to make sure that everyone understands this is a tremendous team effort. That we are a small BI and data analytics team, and we can't do it without our partners in IT, who do a tremendous amount both on infrastructure and data for us, as well as partnering with people out in the business. They're the ones with the use cases that come to mind that say, hey, we want to know something more about something, and whether that be in transmission or generation or distribution, or even our human resources and safety people. They're the ones that have the business need, and it's been great working with them. So it's a tremendous team effort to bring some of these things to life that we're going to talk about today. So I'm just going to go through kind of our analytics maturity, some examples, and then a comment just on how we go forward. So now I'm moving on to slide number three, I think it is, which is our data analytics opportunity. And it has a visualization on there that we use to kind of demonstrate where we are along a maturity model in data analytics here at the district. And it's a very useful kind of paradigm for us just to see where we're working. There's it ranges from the lowest level of, oh my goodness, we have a lot of data, but we don't know what to do with it, all the way up to an eight, which is a process optimization where data becomes really a part of every process that you do, and it really isn't eventful anymore. It's just part of your everyday work. And as we look around the district, we notice that we are kind of in different areas. The organization is in different spots along this continuum. And in general, we have a lot of data, and we're working towards, as a team, organizing that data really well, getting people better access to it, and to make sure that it's utilized broadly so that more people can get more insights from the data that we have. We also have some individual efforts that we'll talk about today. You'll see some examples of that on kind of up in the 6 and 7 range, where we've been doing predictive models or even some using data to do prescriptive actions. And as we move towards 8, it is trying to get us to a place where data does become part of our every operation and the decisions that we make. We're using data to make those for everything from the management of our operations and assets to our distribution reliability, and our HPI and customer service particularly. So we'll walk through that. And I just want to make one comment on this, is that it really is an additive process. Sometimes people look at this value curve and they think that this is, you move up to level 6 and you leave level 4 behind, and that's not the case. So if we are a mature organization, we're really doing all of these at the same time. We're doing 4 for those people that need it. We're doing 5 in those situations that need it. And we're building and building upon it together. So it's a very useful thing for us, and we'll give you some examples of those as we go along here. So I'm going to jump to slide 5, which is our first example. And this is really down in our level 4 area, the business intelligence, like Kelly referenced, that we've been doing for a while in finance, and we wanted to bring this to a broader group. And one of the ways we do that, it really truly is the foundation for any data-driven culture, is to have a lot of business intelligence in front of you. But our history has been a lot of point solutions where people will do individual reports or things for a specific purpose. And what we tried to do is move that to a more reusable model so that we can put data out in front of people and they can use it for multiple purposes and do their own ad hoc analysis from those. And the example that I've thrown up here is simply one we put together for the safety team, which is 10 years of safety statistics that allows us to look at things by location or by the job title of employees and the nature of the different injuries. And you can see how they've trended over time. And in general, we've had a great trend. We've been getting lower and lower on our incident rates. But it helps them be able to analyze these things kind of in an ad hoc fashion rather than having one simple report. And so it's important for us as we build the BI function to be able to build models that people can reuse. And there are these same efforts going on right now for distribution. They're building some models to also help asset condition monitoring. So it's a kind of a different view of the way we build things rather than reports and moving towards reusable models, which is actually helping us expand our capabilities. I'm going to hand this over to Peter now to kind of walk us through what we're doing in some of this examples around our operational data with the hydros.
Before we move on, Curtis, I'd like to go back to the, I think it was slide 4 that has the 1-8, and just compliment you guys in terms of how the clarity that's in that slide and how useful that was in understanding this presentation. So just some feedback. Thank you. Well done.
Oh, no, thank you. Yeah, it's a useful model for us to kind of understand our maturity and it is. It's a good slide to show where different organizations can sit within that continuum. So glad you got something out of that. Okay, jumping back to slide 6.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Vanney. So I'm going to talk about this. We make Power Dashboard that was put together to support the 2-dam independent operations. It's a daily dashboard that increases access and awareness of our operational data. On the dashboard, we combine sensor data stored in our data historian, which is a non-traditional database that does not follow standard table structures. And we're combining that sensor data with forecast data from energy planning and trading. We also incorporate constraints, such as our headwater limits and calculated maximum capacity. This display is on display at the CTC near the Transmission and Compliance Office and also outside the boardroom. We use PyVision to increase accessibility around the district to this data. And PyVision is a tool that we implemented. And Alex actually spoke about it, I think, about a year ago. And because we're using that, anyone at the district who's on our local internet has access to this data. I have a much longer presentation that gets into each quadrant and explains more about what each graph shows and how it impacts operations. But due to time, this isn't quite the right venue. But that presentation has been given to a handful of small groups, and I kind of walk through each piece. Just as a broad overview, we have the quadrant for district load, the different headwaters and inflows in the bottom left, and then on the right-hand side, it's kind of the bigger picture view of what's happening at the projects. There are also two other accompanying more plant-specific dashboards that rotate through the displays at the CTC and outside the boardroom. On slide 7, this is concerning river elevation modeling. So here we're combining real-time sensor data with reference tables to calculate and store river elevation estimates. So this is more in the number 5 mathematical and statistical modeling point on the analytics value curve. To accomplish this, we calculate data and store it in our PI historian. The calculations are grounded in backwater curve studies that were completed for different licensing efforts, and so it is grounded in that base official data. This same data will also be used in the upcoming River Levels app. Each river mile and points of interest, such as parks and boat launches, are calculated and stored because we want this to add value to our customer owners and the people who use the Columbia River between Wells Dam, Rocky Reach, and Rock Island. This effort also enables us to monitor the predictions regarding high water and low water impacts on our two ponds. And it's working in collaboration with other investments for more sensors to validate and improve upon the underlying model. And I'm not sure how many of you are looking at this on a computer, but there is a link to a simulated day that shows the river profile for a 24-hour period. That 24-hour period was an especially interesting day with a lot of movement, which is why I kind of focused on that one. It's not a typical day. But if you have the opportunity, I'd encourage you to check it out, or we can share it if the links aren't working.
Yeah, it was something built for an in-person presentation, so we may have to come back to it at a different date.
All right, this next slide, number 8, is the predictive analytics for stator winding temperatures. The goal here was really to develop a machine learning model to predict temperatures and cooling system efficiency, so we could move from time-based to condition-based maintenance. So we incorporated years of data from sensors and trained a random forest model on the cloud. So the challenge to me and Curtis and Alex and the rest of the people involved with this project is to go from an interesting analysis to something that you can take action on. So to accomplish that, we moved the model to our network from the cloud and wrote computer code to extract data, run it through the model, and store the prediction back in the PI historian. And this now occurs every morning, and we're in the monitor models versus actuals phase. So the accompanying display shows both the actual values and the modeled values in the top left. The other graphs are the main components of the cooling system that are the model inputs. So now that we have some vision on how the model is performing compared to what's actually happening at the plant, we can iterate on the underlying model and work towards incorporating it with our maintenance workflows.
All right, and then we're going to jump over to Alex real quick on slide 9, which is the automated feeder breaker trip notifications.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith, the software and data engineering manager in IT. Unfortunately, I don't have any pretty graphs to show everybody like Peter produced, because kind of what happens behind the scenes is an integration as opposed to anything that you can see visually. But we developed an automated feeder breaker analysis and notification system. I'll note that this was also supposed to be a full presentation that I was going to give at PI World in San Francisco later this month. That's now postponed. I can make that presentation available to anybody that wants to see it in detail. This integration allows us to automatically create service requests in our Maximo work management system based on near real-time operator conditions on our distribution network. Why this is important is that before we had this system in place, we needed to dispatch service crews to check on the clinic's backup power feed every 2 weeks in order to ensure uninterrupted service, somewhat as a stopgap measure. With our new system, we automatically notify the utility maintenance planner of a feeder breaker operation that allows them to dispatch the crew only when needed. In short, we enabled a time-based maintenance schedule every 2 weeks. We went from a time-based maintenance schedule every 2 weeks to a condition-based maintenance schedule, improving service, reducing labor due to unnecessary crew dispatch, and building a more resilient distribution system.
Okay, thanks, Alex. And this is one of the examples of, you know, as we look along that maturity model, this gets us up towards prescriptive analytics. It's a very simple example, simply because the breaker switching is either an on or an off or a true and a false, but it takes that piece of data and then drives action simply from the data itself. It sends a work request automatically. Somebody reviews it and rolls the truck if necessary. And so it's a great example of us building some infrastructure in order to enable data-driven action. So just on our last slide now, I'm on number 10, just continuing forward. The challenges for our team, first of all, there's been a lot of great work that people have done, and there's other examples that we can show, but these are the ones we decided to highlight today. But we really need to scale these insights to grow that organizational maturity. So a lot of the things that are on our plate is to make our data clear and accessible to more employees, but also to invest in growing data literacy across the organization, to help people through the development of their individual development plans to have a place to go so that we have a bit of a curriculum or ways that we can teach people how to do more analytics on their own. So with a small team, we can't do everyone's individual analytics, but we can help them grow their capabilities so that they can do it themselves, and we can organize the data so that they have access to it. Second thing we really need to do is support our technology and innovation roadmap. We have a tremendous roadmap of a lot of new systems coming online in the next several years. So we really need to maximize our investments in those systems. The great value that comes out of those is all the data that we capture in them, and being able to use that data helps us get more value from those systems. Some examples are our advanced metering infrastructure. When that comes online, we are going to have a treasure trove of data to look at around what we can do in the distribution network. But then we also need to be creative with our data and how we can help it to enable our customers, whether that through apps or websites or things like that. But the river mile analysis that Peter covered is an example to be incorporated into our lake level and river level app so that that can give customers estimates on what our river levels are. And the last thing is, as we work with data, is really stay aligned with our mission, vision, and values, is that, you know, we do have to prioritize, and those things that we do pick, we should be doing it with the idea that we are picking those things that are for the best, for the most, for the longest. And as we work with customer data or other data around the district, that we need to do so with a real attitude of stewardship and the trustworthiness that people would expect from us, that we are using the data that we have available to us in a way that that we should do it with our customers in mind. And that's what we have today, and I appreciate, again, the opportunity to share this with everybody.
Commissioners, if I could jump in for a moment, I just want to give a couple of specific examples that you may be able to relate to on the examples that these guys provided to you. First of all, on the two-dam independent operation, the elevation modeling, what that is going to allow us to do, we've talked about having an app for lake level and river levels. This is going to feed that app, so there'll be something really simple and clear that folks will be able to understand, that our customers will be able to understand what's going on with the river at different points in time. On the stator widening temperature issue, you may recall that we had a lot of problems with that a couple of years ago, and the way we would discover it is we'd have crews walking around in the powerhouse, and they would be able to smell a burning smell or a smoke smell or something like that. By then, you've got a pretty big problem, obviously. this allows us to understand when that problem is going to occur before that, hopefully. And the third, automated feeder breaker trip notification, the particular place where this is being used is a feeder that serves the hospital. And so what we're doing was going out there every couple of weeks and checking it to see if there was a problem. And now we're going to be able to do this with and hopefully in a way that allows us to send people at the right times as opposed to sending people out every 2 weeks just to check and see what's going on. So these are real clear signs of opportunities for us to improve productivity and efficiency at the district. I think they're very helpful examples of just the kinds of things we're going to be able to do over the next 5 years as we move to implement our technology roadmaps. With that, I'll turn it to you for questions.
Commissioners, do we have any questions, comments?
This is Commissioner Smith. I'm not sure I'm intelligent enough to have any questions after this presentation. I am just absolutely amazed, thinking of myself as a college student many years ago, doing punch cards on the first room-size computers, how far we have come and how technology can have a positive impact on our utility. And I'm so impressed with the fact that we have the individuals that have just presented to us with this capability of doing this, which I know I will never fully understand, but I find it thoroughly exciting to be part of an organization that's looking forward for how we apply technology to better our lives. And I just want to say a huge, huge thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It is a fun field to work in right now, that's for sure.
Hi, this is Steve McKenna, and just wanted to kind of follow up from you, Randy's comments. Randy, you must be really old if you were in part of the...
Oh, that's cruel.
I think I was in the room next door to you at that time. But anyway, joking aside, coming from a different profession, when you work with staff and you build a culture, it's been my experience that some people, when the idea comes up, should we be doing a better job? How can we do a better job? How can we improve? Some people will say, well, I'm doing a good job. I'm working hard. I'm, you know, and kind of how dare you question my intentions, my skills. And what I find with the use of data in human performance is that it takes that questioning, the mental side of that out of the equation, and it's just data. This is what the data says. It's nothing personal. How do we improve? And, you know, what does the data say? And do we really know that our efforts are really improving, or are they in vain, and is there something better that we can do? And so I just want to, that's just a kind of a roundabout way of saying that the work that you're doing is vitally important. It helps build that culture in a human performance culture of continuous improvement, continuous learning, and looking at the data to help guide us. And so, you know, congratulations to the number cruncher guys there, because you're really... you're really having a very positive impact on culture, whether that's with our customers, our employees, the managers, everybody that's looking at the data. It really becomes the impetus for teamwork, for individual improvement, team improvement, and organizational improvement. And so I think it's vitally valuable, and I just want to thank you for those and nice presentation.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's we view data and business intelligence and data analytics really is the kind of the X-ray or the CT scan into your business operations, and it should give people the ability to see those areas where they can improve and do better, and those things that are really working well. So that is definitely the attitude we take with it, too. And so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Commissioners, any other thoughts or comments? Well, I would just like to add that I think this is an exciting time. And this brings home the fact that, as others have told me, this is not your grandfather's utility anymore. So thank you very much for all that you do.
Commissioners, if we could finish this presentation, I want to say thanks to Kelly. She had a vision for what this could be a few years ago. It started talking about the staffing that we needed and how we moved down this path, led to having these folks be a part of this organization. And I will tell you that initially, I think folks kind of wondered what these folks were going to do. And I can tell you what I see across the organization now is a lot of demand for their services. People are seeing, oh, wow, they're really going to be able to help us be able to do our jobs better. So we've come a long way in the last few years. Thanks to Kelly for getting us started.
Thank you.
With that, we're ready to move on to our next subject, which is the 2020 plan of finance. We're getting closer with respect to the bond issuance. I want to invite Heather Ireland to come up to the stage, and she will be making this morning's presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. This morning, I'll be talking about an update for our 2020 plan of finance, along with our 2020 bond issuance process that we've been working on. To start off on slide two, I wanted to provide just a quick update on where we're at from a timeline standpoint. We'll have a more detailed timeline later on, but just to focus in on some key points we've been at in the recent past and the recent future. In December, the board adopted a reimbursement resolution to preserve flexibility so that we could issue bonds in 2020 if that was still what appeared to be the best from an overall benefit to the district standpoint. Today, I'm not looking for any board action, but I am looking for a little board input. I'm here to provide a market update. Conditions are more favorable for the district issuing bonds in 2020, but obviously the markets are volatile right now. We'll also discuss some next steps and preview documents. In preparation for our action request for the board on March 30th, which will be consideration for adoption of a bond resolution, which would authorize the issuance of a resolution allowing the district to retire bonds and issue new bonds. At that, in advance of that meeting, we'll also be seeking board input in the district's offering documents related to a potential bond issuance, and those materials will be circulated in the board's packet in advance of the March 30th board meeting. Moving on to slide three, just a quick update about the district's finance team. Since the fall of 2019, the district has been working with our team of external experts, including Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, and PFM, Public Financial Management, as our financial advisor. We have also been working with our underwriters, Barclays, to circulate ideas and documents and prepare for this potential bond issuance in 2020. On slide four, just a quick touch base on why in the fall of 2019 we recommended pursuing a 2020 plan of finance that included bond issuance. Primarily, that's to be supportive of both the district's debt philosophy and our strategic priority number two. This allows us to balance the district's financial health, looking at our liquidity position and our leverage ratios. And by doing a balancing act of where is our cash and debt at, that helps us drive our portfolio optimization, which ultimately lowers long-term net interest costs and helps us sustain an excellent financial resiliency while mitigating the risk of large rate increases. Specifically, on slide five, the 2020 plan of finance and a recommendation to issue bonds this year aligns with our debt philosophy and strategic priority two by implementing some of our long-term debt strategies, which flow from that, which includes issuing bonds for longer-term needs in 2 to 3 year intervals, for modernization and expansion capital, and managing to the lowest net interest costs. Some additional benefits of the transactions as proposed include reducing administrative risks and processes, helps us streamline some of the district's lien structures, and eliminate some exposure to federal subsidy risk. How we would accomplish this plan of finance includes a mix of actions which is refinancing older, higher rate bonds, approximately $45 million of those bonds that are outstanding, also paying off older, higher rate bonds of approximately $85 million, and issuing new bonds to fund modernization and expansion capital of around $70 million. In fall of 2019, we anticipated that the district would be able to achieve a combined potential net present value savings of $10 to $15 million. And that net present value savings comes over the life of the bond issues, not all in 1 year. So it would probably be around $1 million a year. We were projecting that in both the expected and the unusual case circumstances for the district, all of the district's metrics would remain either in a neutral to positive benefit from the transaction. In addition, due to the accounting treatment of certain prior bond costs of issuance and issuance premiums, we would also recognize potentially approximately a $500,000 to $1 million net gain in the year 2020, which would impact our bottom line. And that's just due to not spreading some of the amortization of those amounts over the life of the old bonds. We would instead accelerate those and recognize those within the year of 2020 when we accomplish the transaction. So now that we know where we're at, or where we were at, moving to slide six, a market update. We do see continued low long-term rates that offer potentially greater savings opportunities for the district. As many of you are probably aware, there has been significant recent Treasury movement. And while Treasury rates are not exactly aligned with municipal market rates, municipal market rates have improved since the fall of 2019 as well. The top black line on this slide indicates where the rates were when we last evaluated the plan of finance in October of 2019. Through February of 2020, we were seeing a gradual decline in that market condition across the board, and that's the heavy blue line in the middle. At that point, rates would have had to have approximately tripled from around 1.5% to 5% to eliminate all savings that the district could potentially see from this transaction. And since late February, we've continued to see decline in at least Treasury rates, where's that bottom green line showing that we're having more movement. As of this morning, with this weekend's federal funds rate cut, the front end of that green line, the 1 month and 3 month, is down further, and it looks more like a traditional upward sloping line. The longer end of the curve, out in the 10, 20, and 30-year range, is approximately similar to where this green bar is today. And again, while this doesn't represent exactly the rates that the district potentially would experience in the market, it is a data point and certainly something that we're all very aware of as it's discussed in the market often. What that means for the district is that we think we can still achieve the 2020 plan of finance and secure savings for the district. On slide seven, we do believe that we'll still be able to capture neutral to positive impacts to all the district's financial metrics, including reducing lower net interest costs. We also see that there are some opportunities in the current market conditions that allow us to potentially extend some of the new money repayments over a longer term than we are initially anticipating. What this would achieve, it would allow us to reduce pressure on forecasted future borrowings in the 3 to 5 to 10 year range slightly. And it would also allow us to still achieve those anticipated savings levels. So those are good opportunities for the district, and we still do think proceeding forward makes sense. However, there are some additional evolving market conditions that may present a new opportunity that was not previously presented in the fall of 2019. We're currently looking at converting about approximately $61 million of our variable rate bonds to fixed rate bonds. This is something that other issuers are looking at as well. And at this point, we're recommending in the bond documents that we'll discuss next, incorporating provisions in those documents to preserve the flexibility for the district to pursue that if market conditions continue to be favorable. While the long-term interest rates are near the total cost of our short-term variable rates plus some ancillary fees, we don't believe that the district would necessarily achieve significant additional net present value savings on this part of the transaction. those savings might be somewhat neutral. We do believe that it would lock in low rates, reduce administrative issues, and also mitigate some contract renewal risks in the future. So moving over to slide 8, the next decision point the district has will be on March 30th. That's when we'll be asking the board to make a go or no-go decision. And how the board would do that is by considering adoption of the issuance resolution. The key provisions of the issuance resolution include authorizing the retirement of the older, higher interest rate bonds. That's an amount of not to exceed $97 million. $12 million of that is already scheduled to mature on July 1st of 2020, so it's only accelerating the amount by just a few months. It was already within the 2020 plan as it existed. In addition, if the district is going to pursue the payoff of the variable rate bonds, there would be an additional not to exceed amount of up to $45 million included to maintain flexibility as well. The bond resolution would also authorize a not to exceed issuance amount of $170 million, again, which would be inclusive of pursuing those variable rate bond restructuring. That would include refinancing components, new money components, and the flexibility for that potential opportunity. The bond resolution would also set forth the terms and conditions of the bonds and the use of the proceeds, and would approve certain documents in form, which include a draft of the district's official statement that's similar to a prospectus statement that includes all of the material risks that an investor may want to hear about the district's financial and operational condition. It would also approve and form a purchase contract and escrow agreement. It would also approve a not-to-exceed amount for bond and tax counsel services in connection with the issuance, and that amount would be not to exceed $275,000. That amount is slightly higher than the last time we moved forward with the bond issuance process for two reasons. One, we haven't issued bonds in a long time, so that is certainly something that does increase over time. And in addition, this amount preserves the flexibility to move forward with the additional component of the refinancing plan to include the variable rate bonds. If we ultimately decide not to pursue that opportunity, we anticipate that these costs could be slightly lower. It would also authorize district officials to take other necessary actions, such as executing certain documents required to complete the transaction. Additionally, on March 30th, there will be a separate resolution that the board will be asked to consider for adoption, which includes an amendment for an audit service agreement associated with the bond issuance with a not-to-exceed amount of $60,000. The board considered and adopted in August of 2019 an extension of the regular audit services agreement for audits of the district's financial statements through 2021. This is an extension to that service agreement to add an additional amount specific to this bond issuance process. So moving over onto slide 9, this is the more detailed version of the timeline we previewed at the front of this presentation. It would include, our go, no-go decision point with a request for board action on March 30th. If the board does decide to adopt that resolution, as a housekeeping item, most of the signatures related to the bond issuance process do need to be collected at the time of bond closing in late April. But there is one document we can put in place in advance of that April signing that will help the district ensure that we're able to complete the closing process timely and by distance. It's actually a certificate that gets filed with the Washington Secretary of State, and it allows for facsimile signatures on the actual bonds themselves. Traditionally, the actual physical bonds that are issued are signed by hand. Our president, vice president, and secretary of the commission are the ones that would sign those documents. However, with executing signatures and filing them with the Washington Secretary of State in advance of the bond issuance process, it eliminates the need for the physical signatures on the bonds themselves. All of the other documents can be signed remotely, They can be done via distance where they're signed, scanned, and uploaded. And that's actually the process we typically use for a bond closing anyways. So it's not a new and different process. The only new and different component would be filing a certificate with the Secretary of State to ensure that those bonds can be delivered timely. Additional components of the timeline include, again, the board's review of the district's offering documents in the late March to early April timeframe. If the board does adopt the resolution on March 30th, we would proceed with paying off the higher rate bonds with a target date of April 1st. And then publishing our offering documents with a target date of April 10th. That would be after the current financial audit is completed and the district's financials are published for the year. We would proceed with pricing and selling of the new bonds with a target date of April 21st. There would be an opportunity for local interested parties within the four county area of Chelan, Douglas, Grant, and I believe Okanagan counties to express their interest in purchasing bonds through a local selling group member, a broker. We are working with our external finance team to develop that selling group member list. And if a local party is interested in purchasing bonds, they would need to have an account with a broker to execute on that transaction. Debbie Litchfield and myself would be happy to receive any inquiries that local community members have about purchasing bonds, to make sure that we can connect them with those local selling group members, or if they have an existing broker relationship, to make sure that that broker gets added to the local selling group. After pricing and sale of the bonds, there would be board action to sign closing documents. Again, that can all be done by distance, and that would be targeted for April 27th. And then our target date of May 1st would be to actually close the bond transactions by staff, assembling all of the documentation and delivering it to the appropriate parties. That's when we'd actually receive the proceeds of the new bond issuance. And at this time, I know that's a lot of information, but I'd like to pause and ask if there's any questions.
Commissioners, any questions? Hearing none from others, I actually have a couple of questions, which you knew I probably would. In terms of the new issuance, I'm just trying to do some quick math and take a look. So we're talking about refinancing $97 million, $12 million, which is already on schedule.
Mm-hmm.
The authorized issuance not to exceed $170 million. Does that take the $97 into account?
Yes, so it would actually be an early payoff of $97 million. The approximately $12 million that was already scheduled for this year, we would not be issuing new bonds to offset at that amount because it was already scheduled to be paid this year anyways. And the $170 million would include amounts that would generally offset about that $85 million, plus the additional component of if we move forward with paying off a portion of the variable rate bonds, there would be an additional approximately $45 million related to that as well that would be new money issuance. And we also had... Go ahead.
The total, including the variable rate, would not exceed $170 million.
Correct. $170 million would be the maximum amount we would issue, including all of the components of the transaction.
That was my confusion. The second question that I had is with respect to signatures. So if I understand you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you would take some kind of a facsimile of our signatures and apply that to the certificate as opposed to actually physically signing.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, so traditionally, all physical bond documents have to be signed by hand by the, I believe it's the president and secretary of the commission. We also have the vice president sign on an incumbency certificate as kind of a backup. There is a process, and this has been a process that has existed for many years. We actually discussed using it in 2011 when we did our last bond issuance, but at that time elected not to. This time it makes more sense to go ahead and move forward. And it's a process that's administered through a certificate from the Washington Secretary of State, where the president, vice president, and secretary would actually sign that certificate. We would deliver it to the Secretary of State, which would then validate it and hold it on file. And that allows that signature to be applied to the actual certificates, the bonds themselves, and they're deemed complete and actually executed, rather than having to have physical signatures on them.
Perfect. Well, that's great. I'm going to jump ahead in your presentation and just share with you that I was able to sit in at the Washington State Treasurer's office when they were issuing motor vehicle fuel tax revenue bonds. And while the coupons were in the 5% range, the yields on these things were between a little less than 1.5% and 3%, which is really, in today's market, free money. So I'm excited to see you proceed with this. This is an exciting opportunity.
It is. Thank you. It's a little bit more eventful than we anticipated, but unfortunately not something that we haven't seen before. The district issued a lot of bonds in the 07, 08, and 09 timeframe. So we do have experience dealing with this type of volatility. It's just makes stuff just a little bit harder.
So an additional question to follow up on Gary's, I too am very supportive of what you're doing, but trying to get my head around, at the end of the day, if you refinance, you pay off, you borrow new, next year at this time, how will our total outstanding debt change?
So next year, we would be in a slightly lower total debt outstanding position than what we were anticipating currently with our financial forecasts. The reason for that is that we're proposing that the maturities that are scheduled as of right now for 2021 and 2022, that we would, rather than refinancing those very short maturities, we believe it would be better for the district to use liquid cash today to pay those portions off. So there would be just a slight acceleration of a couple of years of otherwise scheduled serial maturities. It won't show up significantly in our metrics, but it is a slight difference. So we would anticipate that our total debt outstanding in 2021, if we proceed with this transaction, would be slightly lower than what we're currently forecasting. By years 2022 and 2023, we should be reasonably neutral. So we're really not trying to reduce debt with this transaction. We're trying to optimize our portfolio between our cash and debt positions to achieve the lowest interest cost in the most stable manner that we can for the district.
Clearly understood and appreciated. What you're doing is exactly the right thing in my book. I mean, I try to take it down to the simple level of telling my kids it's time to refinance their house.
Exactly.
And that's it, this. The timing couldn't be better for us.
Heather, is Kelly Boyd still in the room?
She just stepped out. I'm sure she'll be back in just a moment.
Just have her give me a call at home because we've been talking about a local ratepayer who wants to purchase bonds if we go ahead and execute this transaction. And I just want to make sure we're on target to do that.
We are on target to do that. Heather and Debbie are prepared to support whoever in the county would be interested in purchasing bonds. A special mechanism is being set up to allow that to happen. And so Kelly can talk with you to make sure that the connection is made between that person and any others that should come along that want to have an interest.
Yeah.
But we are prepared to address that.
Yeah, if Kelly has all the information on the person, there's just no need for her to call if she's ready to hand that off and help this person out.
Perfect. Yep.
My understanding is Heather and Debbie have the information as well and can reach out to her And I would just offer to other commissioners, if there's anybody else out there that you think would be interested in investing in the district's bonds, we certainly welcome that. And so please have them get in touch with Heather and Debbie.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Heather, while I've got you there just for a second, and maybe this could be a takeaway, and we can chat about it at some later date. In terms of maximizing benefit of debt, especially long-term debt for the district, have you looked at issuing any zero coupon bonds that would have a long-term maturity?
We haven't been actively evaluating this at this point in time. We're trying to look at the best overall market conditions for the district. And there's quite an interest in those higher, as you mentioned, those higher coupon bonds, 4% and 5% bonds issued at a premium, so that the yields end up being much lower. The district actually currently does have some zero coupon bonds in our portfolio. The Rock Island 1997A bonds were issued in 1997 as zero coupon bonds. I'm not going to lie, as an issuer, they are not our favorite to administer. At the time they were done, though, there was definitely some market reasons and contractual reasons that made the most sense for the district to do. So we certainly don't rule out any options, but really we are trying to look for what is the best opportunity for the district to lower long-term interest costs.
When you have, if you just do me a favor, and maybe this is just a takeaway, and we can talk about it at some point later on, if you talk with bond counsel, if you would just ask them.
Of course.
I'm curious to hear what they would say. And in my mind's eye, I'm thinking, the yields on that are going to be fairly low. We've got a great bond rating. Here's an opportunity to put off into the distance repayment. Anyway, I'd just be curious. I'd appreciate you letting me know what you think.
Of course. We'll follow up with you on that.
Great. Thank you.
If there are no other questions, we will move on to the next agenda item. Are we everybody good?
Commissioner, is everyone okay? Any questions?
No, I'm good.
No, I'm good.
Okay, just reiterate that we have very specific actions that we're planning to bring back to the board at the next meeting, resolution that needs to be addressed, and so you should anticipate that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Okay, next up is a presentation we've been thinking about for quite a few months, actually. We want to give you an update, really a strategic look at what's going on with respect to boat launches, docks, as well as bank stabilization efforts. Ryan Baker and Kyle Endemental are here to make that presentation for you. And they'll give you some examples of some things that are going up too, to bring it into the real world for you. Ryan, turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, Ryan Baker here with Park Superintendent Kyle Endemann. Want to talk to you a bit about a parks update and some projects that we have coming and some that we've done here recently. And then talk about a general overview of what's going on out in the parks world. So kind of break things up with launches and docks, and then we'll transition into erosion control. There is no board action requested today, so please let us know if you have any questions. All right, starting out with slide number 3, talking a little bit about major maintenance. As you well know, we have over 3 million visitors that visit our parks on an annual basis. Looking ahead for the next 5 years, we have O&M costs coming in around $5.5 to $6 million is what it expected. And then if we look at our capital budget, the expectation there for spending is between $1 and $3 million, with the majority of that focused on our boat launches, docks, and erosion control projects. So we track our assets and we monitor them, we inspect them, we implement those into our asset management documentation, and that's generally what it comes forward as projects that you'll see here shortly. Moving along to slide number four, we want to talk to you about some boat launches, docks, and moorage facilities. So we have 13 launch areas in our 15 parks. We have over 35 handling and moorage floats. Those are the floats that you would see when you launch your boat or when you would moor your boat at a campground, for example. We have specific designs that are determined by location. So this is, are they out in the middle of the lake or are they in kind of a slough area? So each one of those docks, we look at kind of what's around them and what influences them. Good news, the new life expectancy for our new docks and launches is 30 plus years. This is another 10 to 15 years more than what we saw in our initial docks that were installed with the constructions of our parks. So what do we consider when we look at replacing these docks? Well, we look at, the future use and the future demand of those areas. We look at the age, the anticipated life cycle of the structure. And then again, we look at where they sit within the river or the lake. We generally will do a public engagement when we look at the design of these docks. We'll ask folks what they think about them, how they're used. And probably the number one thing that we look at is the overall usability and the overall public safety when we decide to create a project. And then last, we look at the costs and replacement. And we typically do this through a condition assessment. So a lot of times with our launches and docks, we don't need to replace everything. We may need to just replace the floats themselves or the piles or some portion of that. So jumping ahead to slide number five, I think this is a really cool slide that shows a cost for our docks, jumping all the way back to 2014 and then looking out into the future. You'll notice that for our docks and launches, that will taper off after 2020, and this is following a 10-year peak of replacements. Again, the new life cycle cost for these docks and launches is 30 years plus, so that's some great news. Don't let the line fool you after 2020 where it flattens out. We'll still have some minor maintenance that our crews will do, replace any boards or any floats, but we're not expecting any major projects after 2024, at least looking out for an additional 30 years. So jumping ahead to slide number six, a project that we're really proud of. Last year, in 2019, we replaced a float out in Riverfront Park. And we also dredged that area, which is exciting because this launch is now usable at the lower end of our licenses. So down to 604, I believe, is the end of the ramp there. So we replaced the launch itself. That's the actual concrete portion of that. And then the new handling floats that you'll see in the photo there to the right. So jumping ahead to slide number seven, a project that we actually started here in March of 2020. If you've been up to Old Mill, you'd probably notice that structure has been out there for 36 years plus. The cost of this project is around $923,000, but what we're going to do with that is actually replace the floats themselves. We're going to fix the piles by encasing them and injecting grout into them, and refurbishing the log boom, the connection, something that has failed quite often, especially with the windy conditions that we have up there. So we're really excited to have a great design. We worked with local stakeholders up there and a lot of folks that use this launch and came up with a design that I think is going to last for quite some time. So keep an eye out for that project to be hopefully completed in the next couple of months. Jumping ahead to slide number eight, we'll go down to Confluence State Park. What we're up to here at this boat launch is replacing the actual planks themselves. This structure as well is 30 plus years old. This is a great example of a partnership with State Parks where they actually replaced the handling floats that you see in the picture there, and we're replacing the actual planks themselves. If you notice in the picture, it's kind of hard to see, but there's actual visual damage to the southern planking on this ramp, and so we'll be able to replace these with some brand new launches that, again, will last hopefully 30 plus years. So we have a completed design, we have the permits in hand, and we're getting ready to go out in April for bid, and hopefully for construction of fall of 2020. So jumping ahead to slide number nine, I'm going to turn it over to Kyle to talk a little bit about erosion, but I wanted to pause to see if there was any questions that the commissioners may have specific to docks and launches and any of the costs associated with those.
Commissioners, any questions?
Yeah, Ryan, Dennis Bowles. Just a question. Do we have any contingency budget plans? Should we become more involved with the Rondo and that boat launch?
Yeah, great question, Commissioner. So right now, we've transitioned from working with the Douglas to the Regional Port Authority. We're still talking about a long-term operating plan. As you probably know, the docks and the facilities there have some RCO funding associated with those. So it's a bit tricky on who pays for that and what that looks like. But we've had a lot of good meetings yet to come, and I think we'll be getting somewhere hopefully this year.
Let me add a couple of quick things. You're going to get an update in manager's item today that we have basically a new agreement with the port to kick the can down the road another year on a Rondo. And I believe at this point we are not reserving funds in our financial forecast for any additional costs at a Rondo. Is that correct, Ryan?
As it relates to the boat launch, that is correct. We are supporting them operationally via an agreement.
Right. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Can you hear me? Hi, Ryan. Yeah, just a question about what, remind me what the status is of the Arondo boat launch or the Arondo Park right now, what our obligation is and what the Douglas County port or the port's obligation is, or Douglas County's, I guess.
Yeah. Great question. So as Steve alluded to, as far as kicking the can, we are planning to do day use operations this year at Arondo River. So we plan on opening up here in April and running through September. There'll be no camping. Still a lot of discussion around what the future of that park is going to be. And you know, as far as our obligation goes, is yes, we do have this in our FERC license, and we are very proud to be partners along with the port. So just general day use operations at this time.
And I'll check, Eric can confirm this. I believe we have no legal obligation to the dock at Arondo. So the question just is, what types of facilities do we want to see there going forward? The legal obligation resides with the Port of Douglas County.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I drive by there and frequently, and it looks nice. You know, it looks like it's being maintained, which is good. So, thank you.
You bet.
All right. If there's no more questions on that part, I will switch gears and we'll talk a little bit about our district shoreline erosion management program. So what have we done so far? Well, we have completed an erosion assessment and mapping. This allows us to find out, you know, where we have potential erosion problems and what their severity is. We've developed multiple design alternatives for site suitability, so we kind of have a different plan for different circumstances and different areas of the river. And we've developed a criteria to prioritize these projects, so which ones get done first. We are currently working on developing an ongoing monitoring and reassessment program. This is kind of important with the river operation now and the fluctuating river flows. And we're also working to secure a 10-year programmatic permit. And this should help streamline the process and reduce costs. And just a quick reminder that erosion control is part of the requirement for our FERC license. Moving on to slide 10. What do we consider when we're looking at erosion control along our park shorelines? Well, we look at the location of the site, the use, public access, public safety, and cultural considerations. So we want to kind of figure out how people are using our shoreline, and then we'll address those to make sure that we kind of funnel them into touch points when we're doing these projects, if that's suitable. We also are trying to decide what design is needed to fix the site for the longest period of time. Moving on to slide 11, you can kind of see here that we have some high priority erosion control projects that are planned over the next 6 years. So you can see our costs kind of rising to deal with these important projects, and then they should start to decrease again substantially after 2025. That's when our identified erosion control projects are kind of coming to an end. Keep in mind, again, that our river operations and the fluctuating river levels may need to be addressed in the future as we kind of get a hold of and an idea of what this will do to our riverbanks. And we'll continue to monitor and, you know, assess erosion in our parks. Moving to slide 12. This is one of the...
Hi, hey, Ryan. Ann here. So does the erosion control, does that cover Lake Chelan as well? I know the PUD's been doing erosion control up and down the lake.
Yes.
The upper end of the lake.
Yes, it does, and we'll address that. We have two projects that we're hoping to kick off this year. One of them is in the Chelan area, so I'll get to that on the next slide.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Okay. One of the projects we're hoping to start construction in the fall of 2020 is Kirby Billingsley Hydro Park. So we have identified four erosion spots, sites in this park. We have a cost, estimated cost of about $730,000. And we've already received all our permitting, our design is complete, and we have a cultural review that's already been done. As you can see in the photo here, we do have some erosion encroaching on park infrastructure, in this case a picnic table, but also, you know, on lawn areas, it's eroding into our irrigation system and stuff. So it's time to address these issues here. Moving on to slide 13, here is the Chelan Area Erosion Control project. So this is Chelan Riverwalk, and specifically the South Shore. So if you've walked along the mile loop there, you may notice that the South Shore, we do have some erosion issues. One of them being near the boat launch. We have, that's the picture on the far left of your screen there with the red orange construction fencing. We have actually lost some park infrastructure, some benches there. And then we have a section along the middle of the South Shore. You can see that in the middle picture right there. And a lot of that erosion is man-made. So people want to access the water. We don't have any swimming areas on any of the mile loops that we have on the river. So... what we are looking to do with this is actually create a couple touch points, the middle being one of them. We already know where people are kind of trying to access the water. So if we can kind of harden off some of the other bank and kind of funnel people into an area that we've designed to handle traffic, we can reduce some erosion. The other site is near the Wooden Avenue Bridge. It's a sandy area. A lot of people go swimming there. They're already accessing water. We're looking at funneling people into this site as well and building that up so we can create or look into creating a swim location and give people are already swimming up there. We're going to look into making that, making an area dedicated for them. And we're hoping to start this project in the fall, but we still have some public engagement and some permitting and stuff to follow up with. Moving on to slide 14, this is the Reach One Trail extension, which we call the Lower Reach Trail, and this is a great partnership that we have with the City of Chelan and the Lake Chelan Trail Alliance. So they're looking at extending about 2.5 miles of single track trail off of the Reach One Trail. Work is expected to start here at the end of March, although maybe with the weather we've had this weekend, that might be delayed a little bit. And they will try to wrap up phase one sometime in the end of April, early May. And then phase two, if they don't get all the work done, will happen in the fall of 2020 or possibly spring of 2021, depending on weather. And, you know, when this trail section is complete, we will let you know when the grand opening is.
Can you explain the various colors of the trail?
Oh, yes. Those are kind of the different loops and areas. So you can see the orangish red loop, or it's not actually a loop. That's the beginning of the trail. So that would start the portion off of Reach One. the current Reach One trail, so right around where Pluto is, if you've walked the trail, the Planet Walk sign, it takes off from there. The light blue area is a loop that goes actually right near the river. It's a beautiful area. It's an area that people really have not been able to access before, and it goes through kind of the, well, where the pine forest used to be, it got burnt, so there's some burnt timber in there, but it's starting to regrow, and it's a really cool area. And then the yellow portion of the trail extends up to kind of a viewpoint, and it looks back over the lake and to the mountains to the west.
I have to comment. I love the idea of departing from Pluto and going out from there.
Yeah. Yes. Any more questions on that one? You're welcome. All right. Moving on to slide 15. So kind of a quick summary. So you heard we have about 3 million visitors annually to our parks, so they are being used. People seem to love them. We have gone through a phase where we've been expending quite a bit of capital money on our docks and launches, and this is kind of coming to an end. So 2021, this is kind of the peak capital projects, the docks and the launches will kind of be completed, and then we'll move on to some erosion projects, and these will peak over the next 6 years, and we'll do some substantial bank erosion and get those sites battened up. Any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Just have a comment. I'd just like to say I really appreciate this, what I would call big picture update of what's going on over the next several years. This is really good for this commissioner. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Comments?
This is Steve McKenna. Just a quick question for my own benefit. The materials in the docks that have improved the length of time, what's the difference between what's being used now and what we'll be installing?
Yeah, great question. I don't remember the specific brand, but I think what you're seeing, Commissioner, is wood to a hard plastic that is coated with some grip. So the decking itself is actually supposed to last 40 years plus. But I can get you the specific name of the brand that we're using. Do you remember?
Oh, in the brand. I just wanted to understand the shift between the wood and what we were moving to. That makes sense. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, so not just the material, it also allows for on the Columbia River for the light passage as well. So lasts a lot longer, holds up, a lot sturdier, not as slippery as wood can be, and then allows for that light passage as well.
And the light passage is important for the juveniles, right?
Correct, for ESA species. Correct.
Thanks, Ryan.
You bet.
Commissioners, any other thoughts or questions? I have one, and back on slide number 13, and this is the proposed swimming areas. Is there any concern at all about risk being that close to where the hydro project would start downstream? As it stands now, we don't have a legitimate swimming area, but once we legitimize it, does that increase our risk?
You want me to go ahead?
Yeah.
Great question, first off, and something, yes, we absolutely will look into. I think what we're seeing operationally right now with the no swimming signs that we have posted in this particular area is folks, they want to swim, they want a place to go. As you're probably well aware of, the boat launch facility itself is adjacent to the dam structure. So where we are thinking about, and this isn't a for sure thing yet, would be closer to the Wooden Avenue Bridge and out of the waterway where boats would come, and an area that we don't see being out in the middle of the lake, if you will, or anywhere really near the dam structure. But absolutely great question, and something we'll definitely need to balance out as we look at that.
Great. Thank you.
This is Steve, just following up on that. I understand the question, and I think it's an appropriate question always to ask on on that. it is quite a ways away from the dam, and I, you know, I'm a big advocate that, you know, it's kind of like going to a college campus, and the grass paths. The students will show us where the paths are at, and I think in this area, the community is showing us where they would like some water access, and I think if we can accommodate that, that's always a great opportunity for our customer owners and visitors to our parks, because there just is not many public access points to the water where they can get in like that. So good questions, and I'm supportive of making those moves towards an appropriate access to the water.
Yeah, and I probably should point out, too, with designated swim areas, they delineate a safe area, not only with signage, but separates folks that are swimming from boat traffic as well. And if you've been up there, you've probably seen folks, they're getting access to that, to the lake there all over the place. And so if we can put them in a safer place, we'd like to be able to do that. Any other questions?
Commissioners, any questions? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next up, we want to give you a legislative update. Of course, the legislature came to a conclusion last week. Sean Seaman is here to provide that.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm happy to say they did adjourn on time, actually a little earlier than normally. They might stay late, but they got out early evening. I think everybody was anxious to complete the session. So it ended on time, March 12th. I just thought it was interesting. There was 1,244 new bills introduced this session. Of course, all the other bills that were still in play from last session, so it meant there was a lot of bills that we were tracking, as were everybody else involved in Olympia. Hit some highlights real quick. 2825, this was the Representative Gaynor bill, the oil-free hub bill. It passed out of the House 93-4 on March 10th, and that's basically where it stayed and where it stopped. It got referred to Ways and Means, but with everything else going on, there was no more action on this bill. The Senator Hawkins bill, 6012, it changed quite a bit over time. It passed out of the Senate 39-9 February 17th, but it was amended in the House Finance based on a lot of different input in by the Utility Committee. Utility community changed quite a bit to expand other eligible hydro projects. It was passed out of the House but never got out of rules, and so both these bills died in those locations. But I think I want to give a lot of thanks to Representative Gaynor and Senator Hawkins for the hard work they put into this, both their bills over the course of the session. There was a lot of back and forth, a lot of time spent on this, and Mike Steele as well, but really with Representative Gaynor and Senator Hawkins for their diligent efforts to try and move these bills.
Sean, I want to provide a little color because I know the board has been tracking this issue a lot. So it was really significant that the Gaynor bill, as amended to apply to all the utilities, passed out of the House. So that was the thing that we were working on with the other hydropower owners, and everyone was trying to push that through the Senate. It did not make it through the Senate. It would have required a two-thirds vote because that bill had not had a hearing, and not having had a hearing, it could not just pass on a simple majority vote. There was some opposition to that bill, unfortunately, having to do with some issues that came up late in the process, having to do with one of the utilities. The main message I'd like to leave with you is we did work very closely with our other hydropower owners. We did make progress. We've stalled out and weren't able to make it, unfortunately. And once we reached that point, there was an effort to try to resurrect the oil-free bill to see if that would pass. And candidly, our other hydropower owners were not willing to allow something to go forward that was just on the basis of oil-free. So we were unable to make it through. So that's where we ended up. We now have to, I think everyone needs a little bit of time to go back and reflect on what happened. I'm guessing we probably need a month or two, and then we'll have to get back together and decide whether there is a strategy for next year or not.
It'll be part of an interim strategy that we'll work towards. And I'll add to that for Steve's point on the Gaynor bill. There were some very strong and supportive comments made by some key Democrats in the House, such as Representative Fitzgibbons, in moving this out. So it's something we can build on as well.
And a 93-4 vote. There were a couple hours there when we felt pretty good.
Yes, that was a strong vote. Anything on those two before we move on just to the bulk of the bills? So I'm on the energy bill slide right now. I'm not going to go through these in detail. I'll ask if you have any questions on any of these, but I think the one I think would be worth talking about is 2405. It's actually been called the C-PACER, and it's commercial property assessed efficiency and resiliency. So what this does is allows commercial property owners to have a way to finance projects. It could be energy efficiency, it could be resilience, such as stormwater or seismic retrofits. It allows a broad spectrum of bill or projects, and basically the loan stays with the property through the life of the property. It's not doesn't go with the owner. And this involves some work by the counties, but they could also defer any of their administrative to Commerce. So it changed a lot from it was initially introduced, and the county's having a lot of input to this to where they could be involved if they want. So this is another way to fund conservation, efficiency, and other mechanisms or other retrofits for buildings throughout the state. The other one I'll talk about is the community solar, and this one actually finally did pass. We ended up being neutral on this one. It does allow for low-income community solar projects throughout the state, but they will be a mechanism to try and prorate where those go. They want to try and spread the little bit of money they have out equitably. So if we were to have a project, for instance, depending on how they do this, it might be a 25 kW project, for instance, might be the size that will be limited to in Chelan County. But it could be a little different, depends on how WSU Energy Extension decides how to move forward. Any questions on any of those bills you see on that first slide on energy bills?
Questions?
I'm going to move on to human resources real quick. We're not going to go through again all these other than to touch on a couple of them. The first one, 6267, the state has a long-term care program in place now. It's similar to our program for long-term care. And this opt-out program would allow employees to opt out of the state's program, which includes some funding through the employees. But if you opt out, you opt out for life. And so that's something that's clearly going to have to be communicated to employees across the state, that if you opt out, you never get to get into this program again. PERS 1 is being increased. This bill's been tried, passage has been tried a couple times, and they will get the 3% not to exceed $65 a month one time. And then a bill that had concerns for us was 5473, and it was going to change unemployment insurance drastically, and all the provisions were eventually negotiated out to be a study instead of actually implementing of these provisions, and they want to study the impact of these provisions on employers over the interim. Any questions on that slide?
Sean, Steve McKenna here. I just am curious, as you look over the past sessions, the past few years, were we in, when I look at concern, support, and neutral, was this a year in general of more neutral to support than concerns than you've seen in past years?
Definitely more than we've seen in the last three sessions, and I think it was just there was so much that took place that we would call these human resource bills over the last three sessions. They were just trying to clean up a few things like they did with the paid family medical leave. These were just revisions instead of a new bill. So I would say the number has gone down, and also the bills of concern have gone down, but that was just probably just the nature of this particular session, Commissioner.
And then overall, would you say the same thing with any of the energy bills or any of the other myriad of bills in the Senate or House?
There was a lot of energy bills that started out in play that never went anywhere, such as a cap and trade or cap and invest. And some of the other energy bills were of less consequence to us. There were some greenhouse gas related bills, for instance, or other bills related to carbon that just didn't impact us, so we weren't tracking those as closely. But I would say the significance of the energy bills was drastically reduced because last year was such a large energy year. So I think there was a burnout on that, and they wanted to move on to other projects and other efforts this year.
Thanks, John.
Moving on to the safety slide, slide 7. A couple of these bills, particularly this 2409, was particularly problematic for self-insurers. There was quite a few new penalties, quite a new actions that if we had taken could have been viewed as being penalty worthy, if you will. And the Washington Self-Employer Association group and other lobbyists worked hard to alter this particular bill, 2409. And although we still, as an industry, did support the bill overall, we ended up having to accept what we got. And it was much less from a burdensome from a penalty standpoint. There's still some aspects to it related to our duties and third-party administrators that will be of concern, problematic, but not the heavy-handed penalties that were in the original bills. Any questions on those two bills? So these are other bills. These are still bills that pass, by the way. I make that clear. These all get through the system. 2588 was one that could have been problematic for us from a standpoint of the Chelan Water District, some of the things they were requiring. And even though it's not ours, we were involved in that one. They changed the aspects of that bill to where we could be neutral. 1888, we're still seeing that one in the news. There's an ask of the governor now to veto this bill. This was the bill that was enhancing some state employee or public employee information. So there's still pressure on the governor to veto that from particularly the newspaper industry. The blockchain work group was Senator Brown group. All it did was put a work group together, and we successfully had PUDs added to that work group. So it's likely that it could be somebody from Chelan be involved in that. John Stoll has been talked about maybe participating in this at some point. And the last one, the pesticides in the water, we became neutral on this one because they went from having trying to determine what the maximum contaminant levels would be to doing a study on this, trying to figure that out. A lot of things got changed to studies this year in the last few moments. Any questions on those? I've all just mentioned suction dredging as a bill that's been in place for a long time. This has to do with the mining that takes particularly for an ESA stream such as the Wenatchee River, and this will now restrict the use of the suction dredging, using the gas pumps to suction out the riverbed and pass it through a sluice, basically, and put some changes around that program, a lot more enforcement or a lot more rules and regulations for that. It's something that was good for those of us with ESA responsibilities, Endangered Species Act. Budget related, we didn't have anything other than the oil fee hubs, of course, was a big one for us. That was really budget we were watching. But Waputa and Chelan in particular helped a lot with trying to increase the funding for the broadband office that was formed last year, but they stripped his budget out from the governor's budget. And we worked through Waputa to get that funding back in place, and now he's fully funded to be able to do his work, he being Russ Elliott, the director of the broadband office. And the last one I had on the budget was a green transportation grant. This was a project or a funding source for Link. They want to do some work related to electric charging of the system, a little infrastructure, and plus some batteries to help reduce the demand on our system and reduce their demand charges. They were the last one on the list, and so they needed to get full funding of this project. And we worked with Senator Hawkins, and Representative Gaynor, who's on transportation, and they helped ensure that that funding did remain in the budget. And we actually pinned a letter for Steve, and we're going to send to the governor's office to continue supporting this funding. Any question on those two?
You say this will be a good thing if it actually does make it across the governor's desk here, but this allows Link to do something that, at least we're told, would be the first in the country of induction charging for electric buses. Certainly helps our system too, because it without this, then you get these big charges on the system that would require a substantial amount of infrastructure. So it was a nice opportunity for us to work with Link.
I had just a few bills of note that did not pass. The wildfire funding was the bill that Commissioner Hillary Franz was promoting that would have put a surcharge on insurance policies. The electric gas disclosure is one that would have changed how we provided information on our bills. Utility connections would have asked utilities to waive connection fees, which was very confusing what a connection fees were going to be. We all thought it was something different. That one did not make it. Residential energy code deferral would have just put off the new upcoming changes to the residential code to try and encourage more building. Idea that would reduce cost of buildings. Pole attachment was back. It really didn't play out much. Talked about cap and trades. Special district commissioner pay, you remember this one, which would have pushed out the adjustments, your every five-year adjustments to your commissioner salaries and per diem, did not pass, so it'll still be, I think it's a June date where they do that, July 1. And electrification was a building electrification bill that would have helped switch between other sources, such as natural gas to electric, heating, cooking, et cetera. And with that, any questions?
Hey, Sean, can you maybe discuss a little bit about the wildfire funding bill and what the resistance was on that?
The main resistance was from the insurance companies, because it would have been $5 per, I think, property and casualty policy across the state. And the concern was that there wasn't a lot of work going on with the insurance company to get them to buy in. And so they just never did at this point. I don't even think this bill got a hearing this year. It got reintroduced, but never got even to a level of a hearing in committee. They did get some wildfire funding in the budget, but I'm not really sure how much that was and who it was directed towards. I assume towards DNR, and I don't know the number.
Do you think that we might see this bill come back, or is it, you think it's just dead?
Well, next session, everything's new again, so I think we will see something back again, and we'll see how active DNR is, Department of Natural Resources is, in the interim to work this, because that'll be an important time period for them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Commissioners, I'd like to make a suggestion. We are through our morning agenda. We are in a position, we think, to move forward with a couple of resolutions. They're both ones that we have discussed previously. But we might also want to address the consent agenda before going there. So that would be my suggestion, at least, is consent agenda, and then we take on one or two resolutions, depending on the amount of time that we have.
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against, say nay. And the ayes have it. Consent agenda approved.
Okay. Next up, I'd like to move to Resolution 15. This is the resolution restating and revising long-range financial policies and targets for the water, wastewater, fiber, and telecom and integrated electric business lines. Lindsay Mons and Mark Millens are here. You may notice I skipped over Agenda 14. That's because we didn't have the staff available to go to that one, so we're just going to jump to 15, and if we have time, 16.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities. Today's resolution that you have before you on restating and revising long-term financial policies for water, wastewater, and fiber is a continuation of the strategic plan implementation where those systems are to be working towards sustainability.
This resolution requests board approval of some key financial indicators for the system that will help us monitor progress towards that goal. These metrics were discussed with you last fall, if you recall, as we were talking through all of our rate planning and scenarios. And the rates that we recommended and then were later implemented or approved in February do reflect and are based on the forecasted progress for these goals. Within the resolution, there are three metrics that we're proposing. The first is a continued liquidity metric. This metric has been used, for about as long as I can remember, and in this case is not changing, not how it's calculated nor what the targets are. So that's one liquidity metric. Another metric, which is a new metric, is debt service as a percent of revenues. This measures the debt incurred compared to the customer revenue base. So it's a measure really of the percent of a customer's bill that goes towards debt payments, so that principal and interest. It's a reflection of the affordability of any new debt. So as we look at incurring new debt on a system, it would tell us how much customers' bills might change as a result of that. For all the systems, the targets for that debt service as a percent of revenue are to be less than 10%. And finally, another new metric would be the operating coverage percentage. This measures the overall revenue sufficiency. So looking at the cost to operate and maintain the systems, as well as covering debt and infrastructure needs. When we were setting this metric, we did take into consideration other sources of infrastructure, capital funding, such as grants and public power benefit. And that's why you see the wastewater and fiber metrics being less than 100% target there. This metric in particular is one of the metrics that's going to take us a while to get there. We have the long-term forecast here to meet this particular metric in 10 plus years. And because of that, we do have some interim monitoring metrics, which I'll let Mark talk about.
Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And staff is recommending we also set five-year interim targets, and these would be based on the 10/31/2019 forecast, which effectively reflects the strategic plan. Strategic financial planning on a quarterly basis, when they produce the financial results, we would be consistent with how we've prepared the business line financial policies actuals versus forecast. So in this case, we would be using the 10/31/2019 forecast as our targets, but then we would be presenting our actual forecast as we go through time. And consistent with what we've done in the past, we would use that balanced scorecard methodology where we would report yellow if we're within 10% of that target metric, or red if we're not meeting that metric.
All right.
And with that, I probably should have done a moment just to introduce this more particularly in case there's the public listening. I know the board's aware. These are issues that we discussed with the board substantially in August and October. This is implementation of the strategic plan that called for moving these businesses towards being self-sufficient and reflects the board guidance with respect to rate adoption as well. The rate adoption moves us on those paths consistent with the financial metrics that are being discussed here today. So not new subjects, and we're bringing them back to set a resolution that would define them with the specifics that are associated with the implementation of the plan. With that, I turn it over to the board for questions.
Commissioners, any questions?
Thank you.
Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and it looks like we're in good shape on time to get to Resolution 16 as well. This is a resolution rescinding and replacing resolution number 11-13687 and authorizing the general manager to enter into transactions for the purchase and sale of electric energy and capacity, including environmental attributes within defined criteria. This, of course, is a follow-on to the presentation that was made at the prior board meeting. We're not planning on repeating that presentation today. I will let you know that this got enough attention that it was one of the highlight items in clearing up this past weekend. So it definitely has caught some attention from folks around the region, not surprisingly, because it reflects what is going on in the region, the concern about the regional supply-demand picture getting tighter and tighter, and the need for sellers to be more conservative with respect to their marketing practices. With that, I'll just ask Jamie and Mike if they have anything they want to offer to the board before we turn it over to them for questions.
No, yeah, I don't think we have anything new to offer at this point in time.
Okay, so they are here to answer questions from the board.
Commissioners, do we have any questions?
All right, with hearing none, that actually would conclude the resolutions that we have at this point. I actually might suggest that rather than pass the resolutions now, we wait for Resolution 14 to be heard in the afternoon, and then we can pass them all as a package. Is that okay with the board?
Fine with me. Works with me.
Sounds good. No, so, Steve, what... with respect to the afternoon, can you give us an idea how much time will be needed, including the executive session?
So we have Resolution 14 that I think might take somewhere 5 to 10 minutes. We have do want to give the board some manager items update. Probably the most important one would be with respect to coronavirus issues. I expect that might take maybe 15 minutes or so. And other than that, we'll just be doing the usual cleanup on commission items, delegation of action items, a few minutes on that. I believe we're probably 30 minutes or less on executive session, but I want to consult with Eric over lunch on that.
Okay.
So I would guess that there's a pretty good chance somewhere between 2 and 2:30 we'd be done, even with the executive session.
Okay. Well, commissioners, I think this is an appropriate time to recess for lunch. We will begin our business session at 1 p.m. this afternoon. We are adjourned.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the March 16, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission. We place great value on public input at all of our meetings, whether you're on the phone joining us or in person. And since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we please ask that you come to the microphone, state your name, address for the record, and limit your comments, please, to 3 minutes. So, commissioners, we're deep into the afternoon session. Steve, is this a point where you might want to introduce Resolution 14?
Yes, I do. So this is a resolution rejecting bids and accepting the bid of Electric Research and Manufacturing Cooperative of Dyesburg, Tennessee, bid number 19-74, for bid price schedule A and C, and rejecting all bids and authorizing the 2020 supply of pad mount and overhead distribution transformers be obtained by negotiation for bid price schedule B. Chad Rissman was here. Daniel was going to come. Are you just going to be doing this one?
Just me.
Okay, great. So Chad's going to handle this today. Great. Welcome, Chad.
Good afternoon. So, distribution transformers, this contract for distribution transformers, the district purchases some 350, 400 transformers a year, uses about that many. These are critical components to new customer connections and also critical for distribution transformer failure. So, we lose about 100 of these a year. So we got to make sure that we keep up an inventory of transformers that we're able to. So we're able to have these on hand to meet demand and growth. The part of the issue with these distribution transformers is they look a little bit more like a commodity. Or one of the challenges with these things is that they look a little bit more like a commodity. We purchase about 50 different types, and of those 50 types, there's about 6 types that we use most commonly. And those most common ones are about $1,000 a piece. So it's really more about the quantities of transformers that we purchase rather than the overall cost. And we're really trying to take a strategic approach at purchasing these transformers from a number of different angles. We want them to be delivered in our non-heavy construction timeframes, where we're trying to, they need to get performance tested and checked against our specifications when they arrive here at the district, make sure that they're safe for our crews. And so they get numbered, they get entered into their catalog system, and then they get put out into the warehouse. We don't have a lot of real estate, so nor do manufacturers, so stockpiling these things is not a great option. So we really got to make sure that we keep the supply chain moving and that we get these things hopefully delivered in a time period where we're not busy doing other things, some more of our downtimes, which is usually in the winter. Of course, we want to be competitive about the prices. Specifications is important to us, as we need to replace these distribution transformers with transformers of 20, 30, 40 years ago. So their brackets and connectors have to be similar. And in a seller's market today, manufacturers are not always wanting to make major adjustments. So we look real closely at our specifications. This last round here for this contract, we cut possibly some 20%, about 20% out of the contract to try to take out any of the non-required specifications. So we're trying to stay competitive, making sure that we get as many bidders as we can. The other thing with these distribution transformers is we evaluate their lifetime costs, including what their losses are. Some transformers manufactured less costs up front, but could be more cost over time because of their losses. So we include that in the contract and in the evaluation. So as Steve said, there's three parts to this bid. The first part is for pole-mounted transformers, which is part A. Part B is for pad-mounted transformers, single phase. And part C is for three-phase pad-mounted transformers. Part C is for three-phase pad-mounted transformers. So we're requesting award to one of the bidders, who was responsive for poles on part A and then also part C, which is three-phase pad-mounted transformers. And then on part B, we were requesting authorization to be able to negotiate, where most of the exceptions that came back were related to delivery. Some the bidders didn't include the cost of delivery, which was a requirement, and then other manufacturers and suppliers exceeded the estimated or the required delivery time of 10 weeks. So what we think that there's a bidder in there that would be able to get real close to what our requirements are, but slightly over. Any questions?
Commissioners, questions? So, Chad, what's the total number of transformers in bulk that we're looking to buy?
This is a 3-year contract with an option to extend to a fourth year. About 350 so we only order on demand and forecasted demand. So
okay.
Forecast is about 350 transformers per year.
Thank you. Jeez. Chad, if I could just ask another question here with respect to our future build-out of substations. Is knowing that we're looking at over 10, maybe 13 or so substations that we're either going to be building new or rebuilding, is that factored into this bid list?
So these are distribution transformers that are connecting up the home, so the power transformers, for the larger transformers, we have a separate contract for. So they're related in terms of growth, yes, and our growth forecasts feeds into both the number of substations and the timing, and then also feeds into the number of these distribution transformers that we'd be purchasing.
Thank you. Commissioners, any other questions?
Okay, I think with that, we are finished with the resolution section and would be ready to act on the agenda items 14, 15, and 16.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I move that we accept resolutions 14, 15, and 16 as presented.
Second.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been seconded. All those in favor say aye. Or I should ask any discussion. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can you clarify who seconded that motion?
Randy did.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we are done with the regular agenda, and we're ready to move to manager items. Justin Erickson has a couple that he wants to bring up.
Okay.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning, Justin. I guess afternoon now.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. My. All right, I do have a couple of updates for you. I will begin with our ongoing discussions regarding Arondo Park on the Douglas County side of the river. You may recall previous update towards the latter part of 2019 where I indicated that we were going to enter into an agreement with the Regional Port Authority for a one-year period of time, which would, and we have now officially done so. The Port Authority did approve that action on March 10th. And so we are into that agreement, which states that we would spend, we would cost share 50% up to a maximum of $30,000. And based on the last couple of years, we believe that that is a realistic number and that we will. And that is fair, and that we will that half of the expenses will not total greater than $30,000. In discussions with the Port Authority, obviously they've had a lot of change now that they're a regional authority and some staffing changes, and they indicated that they may desire to actually extend the one-year contract for another year into 2021, so that they can really get a handle on operations and what the options are on that site. So. Just wanted to mention that to you because we do have in the 2020 performance plan an item that states that we will adopt a long-term management plan. And so that may be pushed out one more year. And just wanted to update you on this situation. I do overall view this as a positive, though, because in our conversations with the port, I think they really want to thoughtfully approach this and look at the options rather than rush to an ultimate decision that may not be in the best long-term interests of either party. So, are there any questions? Okay. Second item I'm going to update you on is I'll refer to an email that I sent over the weekend regarding a proposal that we received from the Historic Downtown Chelan Association. That proposal would repurpose historic lampposts that were that previously resided along Wooden Avenue, and it would result in the installation of a low-lying, kind of 3-foot-tall retaining wall and a seating area along the trail in River Front Park, and just south of the pavilion or thereabouts. And it would utilize about 8 of those historic posts. The historic Association is proposing that they would cover all expenses associated with that. They would actually sell memorial placards that individuals could purchase as one of the ways that they're going to help fund that. The lights will actually be functioning. They're not designed to provide a massive amount of illumination, but are designed to just be very attractive and provide a light glow that really sets the setting for the park and for the history that's in that area adjacent to downtown. The goal is to move relatively quickly on this. It's somewhat dependent upon fundraising, of course, by the association. So I know that they'd love to do it this year and are optimistic, but it certainly may take a little bit longer. So it may be a 2021 project depending upon how quickly they're able to fundraise. They would also, in addition to the drawing that I sent, they would also are planning to install 2 to 4 light posts at a prominent entrance to the park. Right now they're looking at the area between BC McDonald's and Campbell's. So there would actually be a second spot as well. And so we wanted to present this to you for any feedback. And if you're supportive, then we will definitely convey that to the association. And then that will allow them to actually do the more detailed planning work that they need to do. The drawing that I sent is kind of an early concept. They will finalize the plans and prepare it in such a way that they could actually bid the project. And we will be involved all along the way. So we have a good working relationship with the association, and we'll be reviewing the plans, the design work, and probably need to formalize this in some fashion with an operating agreement as well. Any questions?
This is Commissioner Smith, and just a comment. Anytime we can create partnerships with other entities like this and help create buy-in, ownership, whatever you want to call it, in our park system, I think it's a good thing. Yeah, we have to do all the paperwork. We have to make sure that things get maintained and that we're in it for the long run. But creating that connection of the community to the park, I think, is a very, very good thing. Just like the Solar Walk was with the Rotary Club. So that's just a comment.
Thank you, sir.
Justin, this is Steve McKenna. I think I know where the location of this is. I believe, and I think I see in your picture, there's a sloped. I thought the sloped sidewalk went up to the upper sidewalk, but it looks like on the picture that I have, you can barely see the. The outlines of that drawn underneath the trees or something like that. But anyway, that was just for me to get oriented. But this seat, is the retaining wall, I just wanted some clarity. The retaining wall is the seat that you would sit on with these posts spaced periodically along the wall that you would sit on. Is that the idea?
Yes, sir. That is the idea. I think the posts are spaced at about 8-foot intervals, and the drawing does literally show someone sitting on the low wall. And you are correct. There is the kind of the upper portion of the trail. You can't see it well on that drawing because of the tree cover. So it would occupy that space in between those two trail segments. And this is directly south of the kind of the plaza area, if you will, with the flagpole. Yeah.
Great. Well, I think it's a great idea. Unless you want to sit on the grass there, just walking along the path and being able to stop and have a place to sit, that's a great view, great spot. I think that's a great idea that they've come up with. So, sounds good.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you.
Parks. Yeah. I'd also like to give you a little bit of information on parks and kind of how we're responding to the COVID-19 outbreak. And this is definitely a fluid situation. We're actually evaluating language that came out from the governor's office this morning where youth sports was referenced. So so this is obviously a dynamic and things may shift. But in the current environment, we have kept our facilities closed that are currently closed. So those that were closed through normal winter operations, we have remained closed. Those facilities that are open, we have kept open. So that includes restrooms at some of the key areas like Walla Walla Park. And so far, from what we've seen, we've been very consistent with how Washington State Parks, City of Seattle, City of Kirkland, others that have had even a lot of reported COVID cases have operated. So one of the kind of questions that we continue to wrestle with is what to do with the play structures. However, we do have a large play structure at Walla Walla. And so in light of the governor's announcement this morning, we're going to reevaluate that this afternoon, determine whether or not we need to close that. We obviously recognize that our facilities in this time provide a needed outlet for the community where they can get out and do some social distancing, but still get outside and appreciate the environment. But those areas that encourage people to congregate, we're going to continue to monitor closely. The other timing aspect, typically we would open BB Park for camping. This year that was scheduled to open March 27th. And again, we're going to really take the lead of the state and state parks. And since that facility is not open, I think it's likely that we will have an extended closure. But we're going to review what Washington State is doing at other park sites. So as I know, more information relative to the March 27th opening, I will let you know.
Justin?
Yes, sir.
Commissioner Smith here. During commissioner items, I intend to say a few words about an article I read and some other things on coronavirus. I'd really appreciate you making sure you're listening to those comments.
Okay, thank you.
You know what I would suggest is that generally we're clearing the room after comments, and I was going to do some coronavirus updates anyway. Maybe, Commissioner Smith, it might be a good time now if you went ahead and offered those comments.
You bet. I'd be more than happy to. As all my fellow commissioners know, my youngest son has lived for 12 years in Shanghai and has gone through this coronavirus now for several months to the point of being locked down in a society that is very much controlled by a single-party dictatorship and one that none of us care to emulate in any way, shape, or form. But following a conversation with him, I've had multiple conversations about how it's going in Shanghai with coronavirus, and he was talking about being monitored block by block by the party, having guards out every street corner preventing people from moving around. He had time to reflect on that and said, not liking these powers, he said, they stopped the coronavirus cold in a city of 20 million people with this authority by limiting social interaction. And this morning I had the opportunity to read an article in the Washington Post written by Jerry Schiff, S-H-I-H. And the article is Lockdown in Beijing. I watched China beat back coronavirus. And I would recommend everybody to get a hold of that article and read it and recognize what we can do as citizens. We're not in a dictatorial society, but we can, if we take that commitment to conduct ourselves in a manner to have the social
spacing and numerous other things, we can have an impact. I guess that's my whole point, is we all need to take it seriously. It can be done. And so a little bit of editorializing, but those conversations with my son have had an impact on me. So for our utility, we're doing the right thing. We may need to do a lot more.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Smith. This is an opportunity for me to jump into some coronavirus issues. I've got five things that I wanted to share with you today. So first of all, you all saw the memo that I sent out last night to all employees. We are working this morning to reinforce the social distancing issues. I can't say how glad I am that we chose this approach for this board meeting. It's entirely consistent with everything that we can see is the right thing to do. Just having seen some of the modeling data that's out there, it does appear that about the most effective thing you can do is social distancing, and the more that you do, the more effective it is. So I do feel like we're on the right track here. We talked this morning as a senior team, and we are encouraging from the managing director down to the first line supervisor, as rigorous enforcement as we can have while still carrying out the work to accomplish the 6 feet of social distance. And it is awkward. I think we all know it's awkward to do that. It doesn't feel very friendly to operate in that way, and yet it's what we need to do. Second issue is we do struggle. We've been trying to think through what happens if you have someone who is going in for testing for coronavirus, or actually were to test positive. One of our challenges is that because of HIPAA requirements, it would be difficult for us to notify other employees specifically that an employee had taken an action. In addition to that, we also struggle with the fact that 90% of the people who are being tested are testing negative. So the policy that you saw in the memo last night is that if any employee stays home ill or goes home ill, we will dispatch folks to clean their work area and therefore not try to focus on just people who might be infected with coronavirus. We also are trying to do more to identify potentially high-risk employees. You may recall the memo from last week indicated that we had looked at the Department of Health recommendations and had talked to folks both at Confluence and at CDHD about what constitutes high risk. They were reasonably clear with us that something like the 60-year-old age limit didn't mean that if you were 59 years old, you were safe, and if you were just over 60, that you were at risk, that there were factors that needed to be taken into account, including underlying health conditions. Confluence has committed to work with us to be able to identify those, whether someone should be identified as high risk. We have had not very many people identify as high risk for whatever reason. If they are non-emergency, they may well already be working from home. They may have just made the decision that they would work from home, which is the action that we recommend if you're high risk. But we are going to put a greater effort into having supervisors talk to their employees about identifying as high risk because of the potential that we might run into a situation where we have someone that is going in for testing or actually defined as presumptive or confirmed positive. Our actions with respect to high risk might be greater than they would be for a low-risk employee. So we're just trying to do more to make sure that to the extent that people are willing, and they have to be willing, to share with us information about their health status, that we can know about those that are at high risk and hopefully be in a position to be able to help them as appropriate. On the customer service front, we had been working on for a while looking at our policies with respect to payment, particularly if they're delayed payment. What we intend to do and likely we'll be doing later today, I'd say most likely, if not later today, it'll be tomorrow morning, is issuing some kind of notice that says if anyone has a financial difficulty, particularly as a result of the challenges associated with coronavirus, we encourage them to call us and we will work with them. We have tools that we can use, and what we're trying to do is just maintain some flexibility to be able to utilize those tools as appropriate. You know, our folks in customer service are very customer service oriented. They will work with folks, but we want to encourage people to feel like if they're having financial difficulties to call us, and we will certainly work with them to avoid shutoffs, to address what would otherwise be delinquent payments. We are actively tracking the fiber usage across the district to make sure that we've got a sense as to whether we have any congestion problems. At the moment, we don't appear to be having anything that would cause limitations on the use of service, but that may change, and it could be specific to geographic areas. So we will be keeping you informed if we identify any problems in that area. We're developing work plans as well to understand what we can do. We have work that is scheduled for the next couple of weeks, and yet it's a very very difficult time. So, for example, work around hospitals that would be normal course of work, not things that would create high risk. We're considering whether to delay some of those actions just to completely minimize the risk during this time frame. So a variety of activities on the customer service front to try to make sure that we're well positioned to be able to address issues that are likely to arise. Final point, federal legislation. So the House of Representatives passed legislation on Friday. We've been very concerned about it. We've been working on it over the weekend. We've been working with our colleagues at the American Public Power Association and the Large Public Power Council. I want to give credit to Eric's lawyers. They uncovered something this morning that the other lawyers back in D.C. had missed that suggests that there will be potentially some significant ramifications for us. The law as it passed the House would provide 2 weeks of paid leave and extended Family Medical Leave Act provisions. It's a very odd provision because it says that for private companies that are greater than 500 employees, they are exempt from the provisions in the law. For private companies with less than 500 employees, they can qualify for a tax credit. For governmental entities, they are neither exempt nor qualify for the tax credit. Whereas others potentially will not incur costs, and in our industry, I would say the investor-owned utilities and merchant generators would not incur costs, we may well incur costs. We're working to try to get some a communication out to our senators to make them aware that this is a concern. But as you well know, this bill is moving so fast, it may not be possible to have an impact. There has been talk about a technical corrections bill that might show up in the not-too-distant future. There may be an opportunity for a fix there of some kind. But at least for now, we think that there's a fair chance that that may be going into effect. It may be going into effect in the next 24 to 48 hours. So our challenge is that we may well be implementing a new law without any regulations to guide it. We are now working through the challenges of things are just happening so quickly. How do you know what to do? But we feel like we're at least as knowledgeable as anybody else in our public power community about it. And we'll be taking action based on what happens in D.C. in the next couple of days. That's the summary that I have for you. Questions about that?
So, Steve, this is Steve McKenna.
Mm-hmm.
I wa-
wanted to go back and talk about our parks, what's open, what's closed. And I just want to throw out an idea or concern. I don't know if it's appropriate or good, but our people can walk through our parks. We're not closing anything down, which is consistent across the state. But are our bathrooms open?
I'll take it.
Yes, our bathrooms are open. We have few bathrooms open at present because we were just in the phase where we were de-winterizing the restrooms and opening them up for spring. So, for example, we have a bathroom open at Walla Walla Park, given its high usage, and so that one opens, and we actually maintain that one. I think normally we try to maintain it year round.
Okay, so kind of going back to, you know, I'm just wondering for people's safety, not encouraging them to be out too long. What can we close down in the way of bathrooms and playground? Can we put, you know, I think it's appropriate for a few weeks to put up a red fence around our playground and not encourage people to be out there in a public setting. You know, that's just my thought. I don't know if those things are appropriate or a good idea, but
this is Randy, and I'm really supportive of us at least looking at what Steve's talking about. I think that's where I was coming from with my comments.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely going to have more conversation this afternoon on that, and appreciate your thoughts.
So I want to make sure that I understand the comment. I think it's likely a foregone conclusion that we're shutting down the playground. So I don't want to get too far in front of the team, but I think that one seems fairly obvious. Did I understand correctly that Commissioner McKenna and Smith, that you're recommending that we shut the restrooms as well?
Well, looking at the possibility of it, yes, and what the ramifications would be. Minimize the public utilizing, kids are out of school. Mom might go down with several sets of kids if they know it's convenient. And us making it less convenient to potentially discourage them from doing that.
What I was thinking.
Yeah.
Opening up the entire bathroom facilities, encouraging public use, but, you know, plop down one porta potty, you're not making it real comfortable. Don't have staff that are cleaning it. You know, we can contract that out. We're not putting our staff at risk. We're not putting the community at risk, but something inconvenient if you absolutely have to use it, but that's it.
Go ahead. This is Commissioner Bowles. Let me offer a contrary point of view. It has been pretty widely encouraged to go for walks, to be out in the fresh air, to be separate from each other in a safe environment. And if we're going to be in a position where our parks are open and people are going to walk those paths and use them and be in the fresh air, which is one of the ways to counter this virus, I think we ought to have the restrooms open. It just seems counter to me to close them. And I was going to ask the question earlier. I know that Billingsley was closed during the winter, and I was hoping that the answer to that being opened up now is good. I mean, I'd love to see people walking in the park and getting in the fresh air and doing their part in terms of acting, you know, counter to the virus. So, you know, my thoughts are a little different.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Dennis, the reason why I brought this up, during the
lunch break. I don't know if anybody else did this, but I listened to the governor's press conference, and they said something fairly subtle. You know, go ahead and go for a walk, walk down the street, but don't do anything to encourage people congregating in parks and playgrounds, et cetera. And I think that was the gist of it. And so my question is, do the very minimum that doesn't promote parks as a gathering place, but if you want to walk through it and be fairly rapid for your own benefit, do so, but don't make it too convenient. So that's just my advice.
So here's what I'd like to.
I'll keep my mouth.
I fully understand the play equipment. You're going to have kids congregating. They're going to be close. They're going to be crawling over each other. They're going to be crawling over actually a structure that's almost impossible to sanitize. You know, and I can certainly see closing that. But if we're going to leave the paths open, and I'm just coming at to a certain extent, from an ADA position, I don't want to restrict someone's whose handicap's ability to use a restroom.
So here's what I'd like to suggest. You are now living our life for the last 4 days. I can't tell you how many issues like this we have had to deal with, that you're trying to figure out what is the right thing to do. The input is helpful. When we have faced this point in other issues that we've confronted, what we do is we go back to the State Department of Health recommendations, and then if those aren't clear, we go consult with the health professionals in the community, CDHD, Confluence, CVCH, and ask them for guidance on this. So what I'd like to do is now put that into that process and say there's a certain point at which we're beyond our core competency and we need some guidance from people who are tracking this stuff, and that's their full-time job to do this. Does that work?
May I weigh in?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. This is Ann, Commissioner Pongan. I'm in complete agreement with Commissioner Bowles. I do not want to see us. My one opinion is we do not want to shut down all the parks, shut down all the bathrooms. We need to give people a little bit of, I understand what Randy's saying, but, have a little bit of responsibility. Everywhere I've been, people are standing 8 feet apart. And I know not everybody's doing that, and young children won't do that on the playground equipment. But we do not want people locked in their houses watching TV. They need to get out. They need to get out in our parks. It's healthy. It's good for their psyche. So please, I don't want to see us just blanket shut everything down. Doesn't sound like that's the plan, but that's my one humble opinion.
Okay. Commissioner Arsenault, did you want to offer anything?
I think that events are changing rapidly, and that I think this question might resolve itself in the next days or weeks. I was just looking at a news feed as we were talking, and the mayor of San Francisco is now requiring people to stay home and shelter in place in San Francisco. Canada is closing the borders with the United States, still at this point, for the moment, allowing U.S. citizens to come across, but foreign citizens are not allowed. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if this issue resolves itself in the next short while.
I will say that has happened to us a few times over the past few days. We thought we had difficult issues that we were wrestling with, and then all of a sudden the decision got made for us. So that may well happen. We will certainly consult with, like I say, health professionals in the community and get their views on this as well, and I'll let you know where we end up. And we will also, we've talked a lot about the safety of the public. We're also going to give consideration to the safety of our employees. So there's a number of issues to take into account here. Any other thoughts that folks want to offer generally with respect to the report that we provided on coronavirus? Okay. I would like to cover a couple of other issues. First of all, the Stehekin trip is scheduled for March 26th. We did not want to cancel it because there was board interest, but our recommendation would be to cancel that at this point. Any objection? And of course, we will reschedule, but rescheduling will be based on how long this event goes on. Any objection to that?
No, that sounds reasonable.
Okay, and then I do want to mention one other issue that we had planned to bring to you today, public power benefit. We have a performance plan goal to try to get the new criteria for public power benefit in place by the end of this month. In order to do that, we really needed to make a more detailed presentation to you today. We were mostly on course last week, and then we just had no time to do the work that we were trying to finish. I will give you just a brief overview on this to say that we are committed to using the same kind of approach that we used in the last five-year planning period under strategic planning, which is to look backwards at our financial performance. And if you do that, we just had five really tremendous years, averaging over $100 million a year over 2015 through 19. And then looking forward to our financial forecast, which are also good years, but nowhere near as good as the last 5 years. And from that, what we would do is present that information to you. The formula is not meant to give us an answer. Okay, so you look at these two things and there's the answer. It's to give you some things to think about and the decision with respect to what should be made available for public power benefit is at board discretion. What we would intend to do is, through conversations with you over the course of the next couple of weeks, come up with at least a recommendation of what we think should be the type of number that looks like it's in the realm of what works for all of you. And we would do that in two parts. First is we should set a five-year planning number so that for the financial forecast, there is a number included that addresses public power benefit. This is assuming that there will be one. Recall that the topic team recommendation is that we continue it, and our financial performance would suggest that we should continue it. But again, that's a board decision. So we would set a five-year number, and then each year set the one-year number for the following year. So for example, this spring, we would be setting the number for 2021. That basically follows the same process that we used for the last period to have something in the financial forecast across the 5 years, as well as to include, to come back and revisit it annually to say, so how are we doing? And does that number that we put in the financial forecast, does it remain justified? So would have liked to have given you some more details about that today, but not quite ready. So we'll be bringing that for you at the next board meeting. Any questions about that?
Steve, this is Dennis. Just a little bit of input as we're considering that. You know, we've purchased two pieces of property, the Horan House and the McDougal House, and we're looking at creating a trail and maybe a couple of commemorative sites to the Native American culture that first inhabited that property, and secondly, to Horan House as a symbol of the early agricultural industry to celebrate two cultures and two diverse uses of a natural resource that has continued to benefit us all. And I guess I'd like to suggest that as we consider public power benefits that perhaps to do this in a really worthy way, that we consider utilizing some public power benefits in the next few years to augment perhaps some budgetary allotments to really make those two commemorative sites something that both cultures can be proud of, and we can celebrate our past as we look at our future. But anyway, just a thought.
Yeah, I think that fits with our general thinking about this. We have not included the costs of the trail extension in the costs of building the service center. We've thought about it as a public power benefit item, and so that fits with where we're generally headed. The team is now working on developing some schematics for what that area could look like, and we will need to actually engage that because we have about, it's probably more than a half dozen permit issues that have to be addressed with the city of Wenatchee. And I think there is an interest there in understanding what we are trying to do. I think there's an excitement actually there about the things that we are trying to do and where we want to go with this. But I think they're going to want to have some sense of what it is that we're thinking about, because this is their chance actually to review those kinds of issues through the permit process. I see that coming pretty quickly, by the way. Like, we may even be talking about it the next board meeting, possibly.
Thanks.
Any other questions about that?
Yes.
Commissioner Congdon? Yeah.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, did you have a question, Commissioner Congdon?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, I do not. I didn't understand you.
Okay. Okay, so that's it for our manager items, and we are up to commission items.
Commissioners, any items?
Gary, this is Randy, and I have one.
Okay.
I know you've completed your public disclosure statement, or at least I think you have, and I don't know if my fellow commissioners have, but I want to reiterate what we've learned at Waputa. Start early, because I did mine last week. It took me several hours and three calls to the Public Disclosure Commission to get it completed. And so I encourage everybody to start early. Maybe mine is just more complex than most. If the format is so foreign, get it done early. That's all I can say.
Randy, may I support your statement? I did mine, and it was absolutely arduous. I was completely frustrated by the end. I'm sure it took between 2 and 3 hours to do, and it is ugly. So that's as plain as I can be. Well, I could be more plain, but it wouldn't be socially acceptable. I just thought it was horrific.
Yeah.
Okay. If there are no more commission items, I would move on to follow-up of delegation of action items. We had one from the last meeting. We had the customer owner, Charles Follis, who came to visit. There had been some communication with his attorney, and Eric has placed a call to him this morning. And just hasn't heard back from him yet, but we are following up. Just don't have much to report at this point.
Commissioners, Eric, I would add that I have spoken a number of times with Mr. Follis and a couple of his neighbors who are in a similar position, have what I think is a pretty good relationship with him and a path forward. So I'll provide you updates as we move through the process with Mr. Follis and his neighbors.
Thanks, Eric.
That was the only action item from the last meeting. I do have some items to follow up on from this meeting. There was a question from Commissioner Arsenault about the zero coupon bonds and how those might work for us in the future. So we will make sure that we follow up on that. There was a question about I think just wanting to hear back from us about the potential future swim location in Chelan So as our team works through that and comes to some tentative conclusions, we'll bring that back to the commission as well. And then you didn't specifically ask for it, but I feel like we've got a commitment to you anyway to when we get to the point of doing the Chelan Trail opening, we'll notify commissioners to give you an opportunity to participate in that. That's what I got. Anything else missed? Okay. Commissioner Arsenault, we're to additional public comment. I can tell you that there are only the three of us in the room, and we have no public present.
And there's no public on the phone either?
No.
No? Okay, good. Thank you. Well, then I'll skip right over that. Any other general matters of business that might come before the commission, commissioners, any topics? All right, well, hearing none, then we're ready to move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation, to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risks as authorized by RCW, and to review the performance of a employee as, again, authorized by RCW. Steve, how much time do you think we'll need?
30 minutes.
So we'll need 30 minutes. It is 1:57 now. Well, that means we'll probably be coming out around 2:30.
And I would suggest that, okay, commissioners, if you just stay on the line, because I actually think there's a good chance we may do less.
All right.
We are coming out of the executive session. It is March 16, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.